Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. I'm Ruth McKee, editor of Books Ireland, and each episode I ask our guests which books they would save if their house was on fire. Joining me today is author Roma Wells. She's a Sri Lankan and Irish writer whose debut novel, Seek the Singing Fish, is out now with Epoch Press. So yeah, I guess I want to take you back to where you grew up and, you know, who you were as a little girl, as a child, and the books that you first encountered back then.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, as a child, I was always drawn to stories about animals. The animal kingdom was this refuge, it was this sanctuary, and I couldn't get enough of kind of curious creatures, majestic beings beyond the human realm. And it definitely started because of the stories that my granddad would tell me, word of mouth stories. So he grew up in Sri Lanka on the island, and he used to tell me about sloth bears and monkeys that he would raise by hand, crocodiles in the lagoon, cabarago in the long grass. And he would just ignite around animals, and he passed this to me. And so any excuse to read about animals was there from the early on. And my mum as well had a big part in what I chose to read, because she was an animal health inspector, and a huge part of her job was stopping the illegal smuggling of creatures across borders. And so this introduced us to this whole eclectic range of creatures. We had panthers, pythons, scorpions, chameleons, and we'd go along on visitations. She'd bring some back as like a landing base to us. And so I was just fixated as a child on the patterns and movements. So when I think of a story in childhood that really stood out, it was Jonathan Livingston's Seagull. I will never stop raving about this book. It still like fills me with this joy to think about. It's the closest thing to flying I think you can have as a child. Like, It's just stunning. I mean, without giving it away to anyone, it's this book about a young seagull who loves to fly. And unlike the other seagulls who fly for the purpose of getting food and, you know, as a means to an end, he just loves to fly. The process of flying is what ignites him. But he's cast out for this, you know, he's considered, you know, odd for loving flying so much. But this only drives him further to keep flying and learning and twisting and diving. And he kind of reaches this higher state of realm of flying with these other seagulls. But it's not enough. There's something missing, right? And so he misses his flock, and he has this kind of urge to teach and share what he's learned. And I just think it's this beautiful allegory for kind of chasing passion. You know, if you love to do something, you don't go with the flock, you follow that, you know, and you build a life around it, and the power that can have to uplift others when you live that life of passion. And more than anything, I mean, the way that he writes, he has this kind of like liberating style of kind of like diving, dipping, plunging, swirling, crashing into waters, reaching top speeds. And I just, you know, I've looked into the author, and he was a pilot himself, and he was an Air Force captain, and you can really see that love of flying.
Was that a book that was read to you, first of all, or was that a book that you read yourself?
No, so I'm the youngest child of three, and I have two older brothers. So any books that were like popular at the time, the Harry Potter series or Philip Pullman, I was always the last to get them. So I actually found that book myself. It was something my mum had given to me, and it was by my bed all of the time. I used to love to go flying at night with the seagulls. So it was sort of one of the first things I learned to read properly with, actually. And the pictures, it's got picture accompanies, photographs in it of the birds. And so that in itself kind of brought it to life.
And Roma, do you have it there? You have a bit to read for us, do you? Do you have a little excerpt?
I do have a little bit, yeah. Let's have a look. Okay. So this is the point where Jonathan Livingston Seagull, our protagonist, is talking to one of the elder birds who can fly fantastically. And he's talking about reaching the most perfect state of flying that he possibly can. So he says, "You will begin to touch heaven, Jonathan, in the moment that you touch perfect speed. And that isn't flying 1,000 miles an hour or 1,000,000 or flying at the speed of light, because any number is a limit and perfection doesn't have limits. Perfect speed, my son, is being there." And it continues, "But I want to learn to fly like that," Jonathan said, and a strange light glowed in his eyes. "Tell me what to do." Chiang spoke slowly and watched the younger girl ever so carefully. "To fly as fast as thought, to anywhere there is," he said, "you must begin by knowing that you've already arrived." The trick, according to Chiang, was for Jonathan to stop seeing himself as trapped inside a limited body that had a 42-inch wingspan and performance that could be plotted on a chart. The trick was to know that his true nature lived as a perfect, unwritten number everywhere at once across space and time. It's just this expansive feeling of just, oh, you can do anything.
God, I can, oh, and it's so, so strange. I've never come across that before either. So that's another new title, probably a new title for some of our listeners as well. What struck me about the choices from your childhood here was you have, this kind of expanse there that you're talking about and this kind of joy. And there's another writer here that very popular in our house as well, maybe touches on something darker. And you mentioned Lemony Snicket.
Yes, Lemony Snicket. There's this way of bringing that reader into the journey. Now he talks to you, he teases and toys and makes you question if you even want to go on that journey. And that for me was completely unique. You know, I love this idea of there being a kind of whisper in your ear and a kind of higher hand help to take you through the story. And so that was something that definitely in Secret Singing Fish I brought out in this kind of mechanism of shy, of being, you know, taking the reader through a story. So, and I think just darker subject matter in general. I mean, the Darren Chan series were another great one. Like studying kind of grit and gore and violence as a child, it's this sort of excitement you get from it when you're young.
And I think as well, there's that. For me, anyway, I read Lemony Snicket with my children, you know, and what I loved about it was, it wasn't patronizing. It was dealing with hard things, hard truths, and particularly death as well, you know, like head on and not, really quite courageous. I thought I have a line here that I've written, like, because I had this written up as a quote for a while, but it's when he's talking about remembering when someone's not with you anymore, and he says it's like walking up the stairs to your bedroom in the dark and thinking there's one more stair than there is. Your foot falls down through the air and there's that sickly moment of dark surprise as you try and readjust the way you thought of things. Mm-hmm. That sensation, like, you know, and I just thought, mm-hmm. What I actually just had not, you know, read anything that really got that feeling so well, that sort of swelling sense of absence, the shock of it. Yeah. You know, like missing a stair. And I just thought, wow, that's what a great way to explain it to a child as well.
Honestly, that's perfectly encapsulated. It's that kind of, that phantom moment when you expect something to be there and the absence that swells.
And it's not. And this sort of leads me to your next question as well. If we're talking about loss and hard things, you know, you've had difficult points in your life.
Absolutely.
And is there a book that was with you during that time?
Absolutely. So I'd say there was a period of time where I was feeling quite numb, I'd say, and emotionally exhausted and drained. And it was when my best friend quite tragically passed away when we were 21. And just prior to that, a couple of months, my granddad, who, as I mentioned, was an absolute hero, the animal lover. And there was just this feeling of emotional disorientation. I didn't really know where to turn, how to process the grief. And I found a kind of refuge in this book, The Outsider, by Albert Camus, and in general, kind of absurdist literature. And this idea, I think, of starting from the concept that the condition of being human is an absurd experience. You know, we have this inherent drive to find meaning in life, but we're met with this quite meaningless universe. And at first that seems very depressing. You know, it seems like, oh, well, where's the hope then? But it's not nihilist in that, like, you know, everything's futile, don't bother. It's this sense of you can accept the meaninglessness of what's around you, but you can still find a kind of joy and contentment in searching for meaning. And that kind of salvation in small things really spoke to me. So The Outsider, obviously, it's this book that fundamentally is about this Frenchman who commits a murder in colonial Algeria, and it follows his persecution and how he refuses to show any kind of regret or guilt for what he's done. And there's no heroic pretensions. There's no sense of him being a hero, but he is a man who dies for the truth. He refuses to kind of mold to social norms. And there's such a beauty and a power in this story for me, because I just feel it's brave. It's a brave way to be. It's a way of just, and it's not void of emotion. There's an emotional ambivalence at times, but he writes so beautifully when it matters. And there's Camus. I mean, when I read that book, I wanted to read more and more and more of him. And there's this essay he does called The Myth of Sisyphus. And this is one of my favorite things I think I've ever read, where he takes the concept of Sisyphus in Greek mythology. He was condemned to this punishment of meaninglessly rolling a boulder up a hill, having it roll down, up and down, up and down forever. And on the surface, you think this is awful. This is the worst kind of torture there could be. But he says, hang on a minute. if Sisyphus, if we could theorize that Sisyphus actually enjoys the process, you know, he realizes how futile what he's doing is, but he could enjoy the feel of the boulder on his hand or the whoosh as it rolls back down or the sun on his skin. And there's a kind of salvation in the small things. And that really, really resonates with me. And so at a time when I was feeling quite numb and emotionally drained, a story that was set in a time period where I think there was a lot of kind of spiritual exhaustion and in the 40s, it really resonated with me. It was to the point and it offered a hope in a bleak place for me. So I would say that one for sure.
And do you have a little something there from The Outsider that we can hear?
Absolutely. So this is a passage just as he's about to commit the murder. And again, this is not ruining the story. It's written on the back about the murder. My eyes were blinded by this veil of salty tears. All I could feel were the symbols of the sun clashing against my forehead, and indistinctly, the dazzling spear still leaping up off the knife in front of me. It was like a red-hot blade gnawing at my eyelashes and gouging at my stinging eyes. That was when everything shook. The sea swept ashore a great breath of fire. The sky seemed to be spitting, splitting from end to end and raining down sheets of flame. My whole being went tense and I tightened my grip on the gun. The trigger gave. I felt the underside of the polished butt, and there it was, in that sharp but deafening noise, it all started. I shook off the sweat and the sun, and I realized that I destroyed the balance of the day and the perfect silence of the beach where I'd been happy. I fired four more shots at a lifeless body, and the bullet sank in without leaving a mark. And it was like giving four sharp knocks at the door of unhappiness.
Oof,
the tension. Yeah. It oozes, the colour, the emotion is visceral. I love it.
Well, speaking of visceral, and also a little bit about finding solace as well. I mean, I read your novel, Seek the Singing Fish, recently, and, you know, what to say, you know, it blew me away. It's so full of everything you were talking about, what you grew up with, you know, all kinds of animals, all kinds of fascination, curiosity, beauty, but also, you know, what you were just talking about there, the gruesome things, dark things, difficult things, loss, all of that, all kind of wrapped up. So I wanted to ask you if there is writing or book or where you go to for that, or what you read to offer that to you, to yourself.
I would say, I'll be honest, it's probably not reading that I get the inspiration from. It is nature through and through. Like you could talk to anyone I know, I probably spend more time around foxes and squirrels and creatures than humans. And there is a sense of just, it's meditation for me. If I go and sit and spend time with the local animals or just, you know, inhale the greenery under a tree, it re-centers me. It's like an anchor for the soul. So if I'm looking for inspiration, I have a few spots in my local area, and there's a great park, Ali Pali, nearby, and I will sit there, close my eyes, and just breathe in, inhale all the life around me, focus on the details, the glass rays, the insects, the creatures above, the birds, and I allow that to be a kind of palette of inspiration. Because I've always, I don't know, but if you sort of picked up, but during the story, it's very much about, because there's so much darkness and bleakness. It's the sense of comfort and sanctuary you can find in those teeny tiny details when life is pushing you and the human spirit to the absolute extreme. So for me, nature has always been a source of inspiration. And, you know, even things I've started to write next, they all come from nature. There's always going to be that theme in my work.
It's just off the top of my head. I can't remember the name now. Is it The Beauty of Quiet Things or the yes, Solace of Quiet Things? What is it? I go for a while and like, I mean, I'm not quoting it because I can't remember, but you know, it's the one we all know, you know.
We know it, whenever, but we can't name it.
Yeah, you know, whenever the craziness of the world enters in, you know, to go to that wild place and listen to the birds, you know, or listen to the blackbird, you know, it's simple, but it's true, isn't it?
Honestly, and if I'm having a stressful time and, you know, a rough or chaotic day, you know, rough time at work or with partners or anything, I do just sit back and think about the wonder of the animal kingdom. Because if you start thinking about how octopuses have 9 brains and 3 hearts, tiger pee smelling like buttery popcorn, swifts flying for 10 months without landing, it's incredible. It's this filled me with this awe that soaks my senses. And I just think we're a tiny blip in this grand symphony. So let's just try and, you know, save what we have while we can, you know?
And you mention I'll fly away. in your choices. Can you tell me about that?
Absolutely. So this is a poet, Rudy Francisco, who I actually discovered on YouTube. So he does a lot of spoken word poetry, and he speaks with such passion and punch and poise. And I thought, oh, I just have to hear more of this guy's work. And so I checked out this anthology called I'll Fly Away. And it's just beautiful. He takes kind of mundane, everyday moments and infuses them with this kind of legacy. And it moves you in ways I can't really describe. It's sort of ineffable. But he just has this way of taking an emotion. He feels, you know, when he's angry, you know, you feel that anger. When he's in love, you know, you feel it thrumming through your whole body. And I mean, I'd love to read you a couple.
Yes, please do.
Yeah. He creates words which he thinks should exist in the English language for feelings, and then he sets poems to those words. So this one is called, I want the kind of happiness that you can smell in my clothes, a smile so big you can still see it when I'm walking in the opposite direction. I want to laugh so loud my demons pack their belongings and decide to move. So these days, I try to take the most mundane things, like waking up or doing laundry, and challenge myself to carve a small celebration into every single one.
Ah.
Beautiful, is it? There's one more. I mean, I read this for days, Ruth, but there's this one called Have You Ever Noticed? Have you ever noticed how much water hates to argue? How it molds itself into the shape of the poor, makes a home where it lands, but also never gives up its identity. As if to say, sure, I'll stay, but only if I can be myself. I think there's a lesson here.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm going to have to get myself a copy of that. Oh, yes. It's kind of, yeah, infectious as well.
Absolutely. I mean, just taking a simple everyday thing, and then this whole new twist, you see, finds new dimensions in it, and it's beautiful. Yeah,
I mean, that's something that you do as well, I think, to a degree in your writing. Well, I mean, from what I've read of your writing, I think you do something quite similar in that kind of revelatory, you know, I don't know, nourishment or something that you seem to get from our natural world, from the animal kingdom, from just being here. You know, you really get a sense of gratitude from your writing. So something that I find really interesting about your list here is you have a book that is hugely misunderstood and a writer that is often misunderstood. And I'll let you tell our listeners what this is. It's a book that maybe reveals something to you, a different way of thinking.
So, I mean, that would be Lolita by Nabokov. I think it's probably the book I've come back to the most in my life, because I'm just enthralled by this way you can take such a taboo subject, you know, this dark capacity of the human desire, and to weave a story so elegantly around it. You know, use such beautiful, delicious language to tell that story and to convey those feelings. And I find that kind of intoxicating, you know, and obviously the time it came out, it being banned in so many countries and it being quite a brave thing to publish. But for me, it's that juxtaposition of taking something incredibly dark and, you know, components of the human psyche we tend to not like to think about. And then, you know, on the sentence level, creating this rhythm and, you know, the syllable level, the way he tells a story, just you feel and taste it. And, you know, I mean, one of the things I really like about Nabokov is from looking into him, he's a synesthesiac. So he blends senses. So he smells colors and tastes scents and those kind of things. And that comes across in his writing. You get this kind of 4D experience when you're reading it. Like, you really are thrown into the world of Humbert Humbert. And I think that's something that I've sort of tried to emulate, in the sense of, with Seek the Singing Fish, it's a story of intense beauty and breathtaking nature, but also horrific, gratuitous violence. And so bringing those two things together with kind of quite sensory, lyrical language is something that I'd always been inspired by Nabokov for. It's just a stunning way of writing. Mm-hmm. And a subject, it's like floating along on this kind of ominous river that he takes you on. You can't say no, and you're kind of unsettled the whole way. But overall, it's a very memorable reading experience, and it's something unique in literature, I think.
And it's curious that a lot of people won't touch it or won't open it. Mm. Now, you know, and you wonder, would it be published today? I wonder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, same thing a lot with, you know, with comedy, with movies, of anything. Sometimes there's a need to cross those lines, I think, to then, you know, make a more healthy discussion about it. You know, if you cross those lines and you do things that are quite controversial, that can then bring it back into the kind of centerfold of public discussion and things. So I think it's important that we have those kind of works that cross those lines.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. Rima, what are you reading now?
Right now? Yeah. I'm reading a few things, but the one I'm enjoying the most is a book called Songbirds by Christy Lefteri. And so a friend of mine actually recommended, they said, oh, I'm reading a book about a Sri Lankan. And I was like, oh, any chance to read about any other Sri Lankan stories, I'm in. So it's a book, I've just started it, but it's a book about this Sri Lankan domestic worker who's living in Cyprus and she goes missing. And it's kind of piecing together what's happened to her through these two voices of her employer, this woman, Petra, and then this chap who seems to be in love with her. And I've only just started it, as I said, but it's this quite clever way of how the absence of someone in a story can create so much more meaning. When they're not there, every single word they've said, every small action is imbued with this kind of importance that may not really mean anything. And I guess, you know, because of the plight of women murdered in domestic slavery all over the world, there's this symbolism of, you know, people speaking on behalf of her, you know, her voice is not there. And I think that's quite a powerful way to tell a story like this. So I'm excited. I'm really enjoying it. And it's just started to get into a little element of the nature components and the beauty of Cyprus and the flavors there. So
just remind me again of that title so everyone can make a note of that.
Yeah, sure. It's Songbirds.
Okay.
Songbirds. Yeah.
Okay. It's great to get some reading suggestions that are sort of outside, you know, what we're all reading about and what we're all seeing in the papers and the reviews. It was really great to just to find something a little
How about
different.
You? What are you reading at the moment?
Do you know what I'm reading at the moment? I'm actually listening to, and I've nearly finished, which is it, I'm going to get the title wrong now, Lessons in Chemistry Lessons. It's fantastic. Oh my God. You'll have to look up the author because I haven't even made a note of this because no one ever asks me what I'm reading. So I've been blindsided. But it's about a scientist called Elizabeth Zott. And it's set in the 50s. And it is brilliant. It's kind of like a treatise on feminism, but it's also really funny. And I find it, I love a book that can make me laugh. It's just so rare to find a book that can make you laugh and properly, you know, I'll have a little snigger, or sometimes I've actually had a proper, you know, a good giggle. But this is amongst, you know, it's a story, you know, she's a scientist. She ends up on a cookery show. And there's a dog character in it, which he's called 630. His name is 630. And I'm so invested in the dog that I wish that for films, you can Google doesthedogdie.com. So you can know, I wish there was something for novels where you could do that in advance. It's like, I do not want the dog to make some kind of big sacrifice.
Yeah.
I don't want this.
No.
The dog cannot die. So I haven't finished it yet, but I'm more hanging on to find out what happens to him than anything else. He's so adorable. But yeah, I would totally recommend that book if people want to Google it, because I've probably got the title wrong. Lessons in Chemistry Lessons. Anyway, I'm listening to it. I listen to a lot of books when I'm out walking. Yeah. So, which is, I just find it's like someone reading you a bedtime story, you know, whenever you want, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm talking too much about myself.
No, you're not.
Anyway,
it's your podcast. We need more of you.
So I was going to ask you then, it's a divisive question because some people get very uppity about leaving any books in there to burn. And then some people have reams of books they want to leave in there. So is there a book that you would leave to burn in the house?
There is, and I can hear my English teacher scolding me from afar, but it would be Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf. I mean,
burn, heretic, burn.
I have to say, right, I am a huge fan of Virginia Woolf. A Room of One's Own, The Waves, To the Lighthouse, really enjoyed those texts, but Mrs. Dalloway, I know why it's so special. It's the stream of consciousness and this insight into the human condition, but the mundane flow of the story, you know, this day in the life of Clarissa Dalloway, it felt like wading through like clotting gravy. I was like, come on, like, please, so I needed some more. And I guess when you're forced to kind of analyze it at the sentence level, you know, and break it down, it's like standing really close up to a painting, you know, you can't appreciate it by like intensively staring right up close to it. So I think I appreciated it more. I've come back and read it since I was doing my A levels, and I have enjoyed more. And I actually quite like the the way she kind of, she changes up what you need for a story, because you don't necessarily have to have mad tension and plot twists and things. It's this quiet excavation of the human condition. And that's a beautiful thing. But I really think at the time I was reading it, I had found The Kite Runner.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
I mean, it was a bit of a mistake because I had this, you know, this whole flavorsome, delicious world of The Kite Runner. And it's like, it's kind of like the equivalent of having this delicious, you know, flavored chocolate sundae in one hand, and then you've got this classic vanilla cone in the other. And you know, the vanilla is a classic, you know, of course it's a classic, but you know, I wanted to, my taste buds wanted the sundae, and I was enjoying The Kite Runner in the world and the way he melts you into that storyscape. So I think my mind wants to travel when I read. I like to go to foreign lands. I like to be, you know, plunged into these blistering foreign terrains and and buttered into the minds of these characters. And I didn't get that with Mrs. Dalloway.
Yeah, it's very different, isn't it? There's that interiority, and it can be quite sort of relentless. Yeah, no, I can get where, where you're coming. Well, she's, Mrs. Dalloway is in there. There you go, in there. Joining a growing cast of people in there. So sorry, Virginia Woolf. She's in there. Now, I was asking you, or I wanted to ask you about a non-book item, but a caveat, you can't. Animals, pets, and human beings are excluded from this question, okay, because of course we're all going to, you know, they're not just non-book animals, they're family members. So we can't
exactly.
So this, you know, excluding your lovely cat and any other animals you may love, what would you save from The Burning House that isn't a book?
Ooh, so I don't even have to think about this one. This is very clear for me. I've thought about this a lot throughout life. So there is a chest in my living room called my nostalgia chest. And so anytime something important or meaningful or funny from the past happens, I pop it in this chest. And it's just this teeming with life. And from creature curiosities. So when I was studying tigers intensely, you know, I love the smell of it. And it sounds terrible. I love the smell of tiger urine because it smells like buttery popcorn. And so I've got the leaves saved in this chest. I've got quills from porcupines. I've got gemstones that just, you know, ignite something in me, and letters from friends and all these bits and bobs. But most importantly in there is a journal that I wrote to my future self. So I started writing it at age 10. And it's written to the future Roma Wells. And it's all these little anecdotes and pieces of my life growing up that I thought would be important for my future self to remember. And it's written as a kind of conversation. So sort of, do you remember this? I hope you remember this. You should remember this. I hope your memory's not gone by now. And it's quite sassy, if I'm honest. But it details all, you know, the usual teenage things and boys and crushes and parties and all that. But the interesting thing is I had a skim of it the other day, and the small kind of boring details are the most beautiful, you know. It's things like the argument that I had with my brother in the morning, or the smell of mum's cooking on a Sunday morning. Like those things really just immerses you in the nostalgia all over again. So it feels like a real, it's like going back in time when I open that chest. So for me, it would be that nostalgia.
Absolutely. Imagine what that's going to be like in 20 years. Oh my goodness.
How about you? What would you take in the fire?
I really don't know. I've thought about that before, and it sounds very boring to say probably. I don't think there is any object. I mean, if I could grab my guitar, I would grab my guitar. But I don't think that there's anything that I actually own or have that I would go back to, that I would particularly need to see. Maybe that, I don't know. I don't know whether that makes me kind of free from those things or not. If you'd asked me maybe 10, 15 years ago, I probably would have said possibly something similar to yourself, but I actually got rid of all of that stuff.
Really?
A few years ago, yeah. I think you're beginning to understand my personality. So I don't have, I had a big and ever sort of growing box of things, and eventually I just thought, no, that's sort of, the past is the past in a way, if you know what I mean. I had letters from, you know, old boyfriends and all sorts of things like that. And they've gone now. Gone. Yeah. I know. I'll probably regret it. You know, I'll be sitting in my rocking chair at some point going, where was the lock of hair from that boy that I knew?
Lock of hair? All right.
There were locks of hair. The funny thing was, there were quite a few locks of hair, and then I couldn't work out who was whose at one point. I thought, oh, well, you know, by this stage. But
oh, my gosh. Could have weaved it. Quilt for your grandchildren.
Oh dear. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, it's, I never ask myself these questions. Roma, you're really putting me on the spot now.
Cool. Like, when you smiled, as soon as I asked that, you smiled at the thought of not having it. So you clearly manipulated. Like, it's clearly working.
No, it's probably
get rid of it.
It's a smile of mania. I don't know. Right, I've completely lost my train of thought. Like, oh yes, I was going to ask you to leave us with a little bit from Seek the Singing Fish. But first of all, I've read it, and I sort of assume everyone else has read it, but of course some people won't have got to it. So would you let everybody know just a sort of a wee bit about the book, and then if you can finish with just a reading from it, that would be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. So Seek the Singing Fish at the core is a story about the power of the natural world as a refuge and a sanctuary when the human spirit is pushed to the extreme. So it charts the journey, the odyssey of Myla, this young girl who grows up in the Sri Lankan Civil War, and she goes on this intensely traumatic journey, and we see how she finds salvation through the small things and the beauty in the world around her. And it's a story of homecoming, it's a story of betrayal, it's a story with twists and turns and bends, and it's a story that I would absolutely love you to read. And on that note,
I second that, by the way. You should definitely read this book.
Oh, thank you, Ruth. Best hype, woman. So I think I'll read you an extract from a Pars study. So Myla lives and breathes in her father's study, which is this inky jungle. And so she grows up kind of just immersed in books. As I sat in a Pars library, inhaling the intoxicating oaky scents, I'd often wonder what trees those books started out life as. I wondered about the contours of their bark, the spread of their roots, and the creatures that once nestled in their branches. When I walked through a dense thicket of trees, I sometimes had the thought in reverse. I wondered what stories they may one day hold, what words might be immortalized in their splendid, sacrificial skin. When our time comes to return to the earth and our bodies feed the soil, perhaps we revive again in the trees, set to turn into untold stories held between unborn palms. Maybe one day, my body will become bound in the pages of a story your great-grandchild holds.
Gorgeous. Roma, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me, Ruth. It's been an absolute delight and a pleasure.
That was, of course, the wonderful Roma Wells reading from her debut novel, Seek the Singing Fish. And that's out now with Epoch Press. You've been listening to Burning Books, supported by the Arts Council of Ireland. See you all next time.